and then more attempts by activists to move into the hacker movement to start to use these skills and tools in order to promote other kinds of values, like anti, for instance, anti-GIF, GMO, or whatever it might be. These are sort of concrete examples of a continuity. But if looking at what is the political claims of the hacker movement itself, like what would I think, for all the differences here in this room and other places, what would sort of boil down the claims or the kind of the statements which people could unite behind? I think they are very very focused and quite, to look at it, very little. It is, first of all, the right to share information, and the second is, I would claim, the right to be anonymous while you are using computers and so forth. Maybe there are other things surrounding that too, but I think those are the core values of this political movement. And this, I would say, is also where the break is in relation to previous forms, like the new social movement and the labor movement. That what is sort of what these two claims, the right to free information and the right to be anonymous, points back at is the absolute right of the individual or the user to be sovereign, that you a trust placed on the user to know his or her affairs best. And I think this is a contrast to how the rhetoric was often the rhetoric was and how the problems was conceptualized, perhaps to some extent in the new social movement and definitely in the labor movement, which had to a large extent a much more collective way of defining these problems. So putting it like this, one could say that if the old sort of slogan was all rights and all power to the people, what would be sort of part of the hacker and to some extent the fascist movement would be to say all power to the individual or all power to the user. And this would sort of constitute the break in a sense. But of course, this claim in itself then has consequences for society, it has consequences for how groups interact and so on. So it's not to say that it's apolitical in that sense. Now, when the new social movement in the 60s and 70s broke out of what was the labor movement before, there was a very heavy critique against it by the labor movement, which has been carried on by the old left, so to speak. It was accused of being hedonistic, it was accused of being very disorganized, and it was accused of being opportunistic, among other things. And I think there was some kind of serious mismatch where the kind of new problem which was raised by feminism and environmentalism and so forth just could not really be placed within the formal frame, the kind of way of defining what was the relevant issues as they had been before, as they were familiar to the labor movement. And from that perspective, you would see what was actually what was happening there as a very opportunistic and hedonistic way of framing issues. And to some extent, I would say this is sort of repeated now, that it's the same kind of critique, especially as concerns the fascist movement, you will have from what has been traditional, let's say, the traditional political establishment towards, in particular, fascists, but also perhaps to an extent, that it is seen as being very individualistic and not always recognized as a political force. Of course, everyone here knows differently, but I think this is the general perception. And I would, throwing out another slogan, catchword, I could say that this sort of, all of these changes in sensibilities, this changes the way of framing the issue, could be seen as a transition going from what you had in the labor movement and to some extent in the new social movement, which was essentially a struggle against unfreedom. And what the step taken here is that it is a struggle for freedom, which is not the same things. These things are related, but they also sometimes end up in conflict, and it makes things look very different depending on where you stand. If you stand against unfreedom or you stand for freedom, so to speak. I'm not sure if it makes sense, but hopefully it will be there. So, to try to become a little bit more concrete, I want to run through very quickly what kind of historical connections I can see, first within the old labor movement and then within the new social movement, and how we could sort of bring out the historical threads which connects back to these previous historical threads. And this, I think, has not been done very much because when there has been writings trying to tell the story about computers or even the story about hackers, I think the tendency is to begin with, if you have a critical kind of scholarly position on it, you start with the military industrial complex, and there is a tendency of locating this to the Mao Doctrine and the Cold War. So that kind of side of the story has been told, but I don't think the sort of labor history side has been told to the same extent. At least it hasn't been publicized so much. It could be argued, I've argued this before in my book, maybe some of you have read by now, that the first embryo of software was invented in the French textile industry in the 18th century. And maybe I don't know how familiar, some of you are probably familiar with it, but I run through it. So the French textile industry was very renowned to produce luxury texture for the court and similar things. Much of the technology developed in that time did not take place within the industries, because the industries was often, there were guilds and so on, which prevented much innovation taking place there. But innovation took place for the courts to a large extent. And also a lot of science was taking place for the courts, and I was geared towards having fun, which also makes an interesting connection to today. But anyway, so there was attempts made throughout the 18th century to modernize the way that the textiles were produced. It was a very expensive luxury product which could only be afforded by very much affluent. And in the fresh textile industry, there were these attempts to mechanize the loom as the machine by which the textiles were produced. This eventually was successfully done by, and you have to pardon my French, and I say it because I don't know French, Joseph Marie Jacquard, so however you pronounce it. That displayed the first of these mechanical looms in 1901, but there had been development for 50 years before that. And putting it very briefly, he used a hole cut mechanism in order to steer this loom. The hole cut mechanism was basically that you had a row of cards, and you had the cards punched with holes. And depending on where the holes were, it was running through the loop, and it told it, the machine, when to put in threads and when not to put in threads. So through the holes punched into the cards, you could store information about the textile which were going to be manufactured. And this might seem as a technical improvement, but the effect it actually had was, firstly, that the machine could be operated with one instead of two workers, as I've been before. And secondly, all the knowledge which the weaver had sort of acquired, all the experience she had or he had, because at that time he was both, but in any case, that kind of tacit knowledge they had over how to produce the textile was suddenly not relevant anymore, because the machine had already could already give instructions through the punched cards, and all the weaver had to do was to attend the machine, that nothing was made functioning. Which means that a lot of people in Lyon, which were the main center for this, and where Joseph Marie Jacquard introduced the machine, there was huge unemployment. They saw this as a great risk towards both their knowledge, their skills, and to their employment. So what the weavers did was that they threw in their wooden shoes into it, their sabot, and that's where you have sabotage from. Which leads me to the first conclusion, that is that the first attempt to computerize a workplace is also the first attempt of conflict and a hack, basically, the wooden shoe into the weaver machine. And this kind of conflict continued and was actually at the center of the conflict which we now know as the Ludis, the Ludi movement in the 1811, 1812 was like the peak of the Ludis in Britain. And they were not using this computerized loom because it had yet been important to Britain because of trade wars and other things. But there were other similar improvements made in the textile industry which posed similar kind of challenges and problems for those people who were working in the textile industry. And what the Ludit was, generally there is a whole idea of the Ludit as anti-technology, sort of phobic kind of character, but what they were in fact was artisans and craftsmen and skilled people who were protecting the skills they had from being replaced and lost to this kind of new machines being introduced. And they did so famously by breaking the machinery. So there is, I think, this might be my surprising connection there, to say that there is actually a connection going from the hackers and who then stereotypically we have a very positive image of the technology and alluded to the kind of movement, because what is central in both cases is the preservation of skills. The skills which we have and the tools by which we can access the technology. That was the case then and that is the case now, I will claim. I will try to say it a few more times to you believe. Oh, you're all against me when I'm in. So this kind of this question of skills versus manufacturing was being sort of fought out throughout the 19th century, especially in England to start with. And there was another movement which arose around this, which was called the Art and Crafts Movement. It was partly concerned about quite different things, like the decoration of a certain idea of architecture and so on, but it also had a core of preserving the kind of skill of the craftsman, an idea of the work of art itself as a value, as opposed to as mere functionality. And while this arts and crafts movement was very closely related to Romanticism and a very anti-industrialism idea, which might seem also very, perhaps very foreign to the hackers in general, I think this idea of seeing software code not as mere functionality, but actually seeing it as a work of art in itself, is another parallel, which is very important, both to the politics which emerged in the arts and craft movement and the one which is happening here today. Right. So these attempts to introduce and build the machines so that those who was working with them would lose control over their own of the tools and the skills. They were from a very early point of time systematized and analyzed and written about by Babbage, and he wrote a book in 1832 or 1833, I don't remember exactly now, where he described these things, how you could separate the knowledge, which previously, the tacit knowledge, which previously has been had by the people who were working in the factory, building it into the machine, and thus more easily being able to control what was happening in order to impose a different speed on the or work pace or to prevent. He says, if I remember correctly, and I do this from my head, the machine can put a check on human inattention, dishonesty, or something else which I've forgotten now. So basically he was putting out all the basic theory which we now associate with Taylor. I mean, this is Taylorism as we understand it. All of this he put out on paper 70 years before. However, Babesh in this case is particularly interesting, of course, because as I guess most of us know, he is also considered as one of the founding fathers of modern computer science. He tried to build a computer drawing from the ideas which Maurice Jacquard had invented with Holcomb, trying to put this Holcomb mechanism into a general calculator. The goal of that calculator was to be able to calculate things for particularly the artillery and for the navy, which they use. And this job has previously been done manually by people who were calculating it with just using tables and rulers and very manually. And he tried to build a machine in order to replace them again using the whole card system. He failed, but the principles which he worked out is now considered to be very, well, to pioneer the idea of modern computer science. And this sort of tailoring strategy came truly to fruition, blossomed in the industry during the 20th century, when various forms of computers was introduced into the heavy industry. Numerical control was a big issue for some time. Within the printing industry, there was major conflict because at the previous date, the printers had a lot of control over the process by which they were typing and so on, the machinery, they knew how it worked. And computerization, early forms of computerization was introduced, trying to replace them, or at least to replace the knowledge they had. And similar things happened within manufacturing and so forth. And here there is a historian who I think, if you find this a little bit interesting, is really worth reading, called David Noble. And he made a study of in one of these factories where he interviewed the managers and he interviewed the workers. For what the managers tried to do was to make, what they were doing was basically building parts for the, it wasn't in the US, they were building parts for the air, like critical parts for helicopters and airs and so on. And these workers were operating machine tools, so it was very critical what they were doing. The parts had to be very specific. And the management tried to introduce numerical controls, which was sort of this early form of computers. And they also tried to prevent the operators from understanding and getting access to the software. And instead, of course, there were engineers to become programmers who programmed the machines and knew how it worked. And they were all kept separate, and they were placed in a different area in the factory than those who were actually working with the machinery. The interesting thing here, there's just a small point that we make, is that the workers, though they were not expected to understand how the machine worked and how the program worked, they learned by themselves because they saw the machine every day, where it was the one which they had the most close relation to. So by reinterpreting and sort of reverse engineering, they learned to understand how the machine worked. And as soon as they understand the machine, they could also change it. And the change they made, and this happened quite under a 10-15-year period, was that they lowered the pace of the machine. So they were working, they lowered the machine 8%, and they could take a break now and then. And the manager, seeing this happening, their response was trying to build the machine even more secure and prevent the workers from actually getting access to it. So here we have a wonderful example, I think, of how access to source code cuts right through the issue of who has the power over your everyday life. right. So this is 1960s and 1970s, and at the same time as this happened, you had also in society more generally a general unease towards where things were coming, and an unease towards technology, which was very broad and to some extent philosophical movement with Heidegger and other people who were thinking on it on a very abstract level. But you had also, within the students' movement, within what became new social movements, within the hippies and so forth, you had also a critique which was more specifically targeting computerization. So in demonstrations, people were hanging pole cards around the neck and basically to raising the same fears as we do around the FRA law today. They were seeing a future of a computerized dome and so on. And very much of this was angst or anxiety was concerned specifically the mainframe computer. And some of the people who were involved in this, it was actually also part of starting up the Homebrew Computer Club and took those first steps of, they at least played a part in the development of that happened in Homebrew Computer Club on the West Coast in the US. So there is a personal connection between the new social movements, especially the environmental movements, and their ideas of building a small technology, the idea of a technology which would be reproducible, which would be under local control, environmentally friendly and so forth. And these people were also engaged in building a small computer, which in the end became the personal computer to some extent. Though of course IBM, realizing what was happening, seeing Apple taking market shares, they started to produce it themselves. But previous to that date, IBM, of course, had been the very antithesis of the personal computer. Let's see my time. So, this was happening. At the same time, there was also a transition happening within the education system. So you had the new social movements, which was growing, and it was, at least in the US, the anti-Vietnam War and so on was major topics. But one reason for this was because people entered the college system. They became students because they didn't want to be sent to Vietnam. So it was this very strong connection to the peace movement. And so you had a very strong expansion of the college system, and also an expansion of people being educated as programmers. But when this happened, what came as a consequence of this was a change in what it meant to be a programmer. Before that, in the 50s and going back, if you were programming computers, you were probably a professor in mathematics or something similar. And you had a very, very particular kind of situation within you were developing software. And gradually, as more and more people were becoming educated into as a specific task of programming computers. And secondly, as there were more and more computers around, because you have a personal computer, software was no longer a specific thing for research projects, but was a commodity which was bought and sold to consumers and so forth. You had a similar kind of transformation of what it meant to be a programmer, the kind of the work relations of being a programmer. Basically, when before this knowledge had been applied, the knowledge of the engineers, the white-collar programmers, had been applied in heavy industry in order to take away the knowledge from the blue-collar workers, to take away that and put it within machine code. What has increasingly happened is that the engineers, the programmers themselves, have the work has become more routinized, and they have become the blue-collar workers in this society. And it's actually the knowledge of their knowledge, our knowledge, which are being taken away from us, or at least which is being fought over. You can, if you read journals in computers and journals in management science from the 60s and 70s, it's full of ideas of how do we curb this kind of tacit knowledge of the programmer. The programmer wants to make it into a black art, and the question is how do we introduce a scientific way of developing the code solutions. And this is a problem which is again and again being debated within these journals if you go back to the 60s and 70s. So there was a very heavy attempt to a very strong force trying to make programming into the same kind of routinized task as you had seen happening before in other fields, like as happened to the weavers, as happened to the arts and crafts movements, as happened to the manufacturers in the heavy industry and so forth. This leads me to my next proposal, and that is that we should see free and open source software. We have to see it in many angles, and it fulfills many purposes, of course. But I think one way of seeing it is to see it as a resistance against Taylorism. I see it as a resistance against this development towards routinizing and sort of making programming into a routinized task. FOSS is resisting this in the sense that it's a question of voting which of feeds. When people, again, we go back to when this happened to the programmers in the 1960s and 1970s and 80s, that software became a commercial product, that it had to be developed within terms and conditions that was defined by an industry that was producing for a market and so on. The old privileges which had been had by the programming profession was being lost. And what some people did was basically to take their skills and their tools and start to develop technologies, start to develop software outside the firms, outside these sort of regulated bureaucratic means of doing it. This is basically what in the end has become the FOSS community. It is a question of voting with the feet. And now this has become so successful that the firms have no alternative but to go after. They have to recognize that this way of organizing the relations between people who are developing, the organizing developers and their relations, is in many ways more superior than how it can be organized within the firm. And this we have many people writing books about now, Banker and so forth, though they avoid, of course, to mention the labor issue side of it. So what the firms have been, more and more what I think we can see is that the computer industry has to organize itself as something very similar to the music industry. And the music industry, quite to contrary to the popular perception, is actually at the forefront there. Because what the music industry has been for at least 50 years is that it is producing nothing. It has no innovation, it has no research and development department within the music industry. It is all innovation is taking place in youth subcultures. It is taking place among those people who claim to oppose and who do think that they oppose the music industry often. I mean, almost every of these fads, from the rap to the punk and so on, has to some extent been targeting and been against the music industry. But the music industry has organized itself very craftily in the sense that it is just appropriating these innovations. It's an outsourcing of the research of new music fads, you could say. And this, I think, could be held in parallel to how the computer industry tries to develop a relation with the free and open source software community, that is to outsource the development of technology to these groups. But there are problems. There are problems because what this leads to, of course, is a loss of control. Before, what technology was coming out of the firm, what technology that was being developed by the employees, could very easily be surveyed and controlled within the firm. And it was all regulated in the employment contracts. If someone tried to develop something which was not sort of in line with what was in the interest of the company, you would fire him, and it would be the end of that. But this is no longer the case, and I think that the file-sharing systems could prove the point quite well, that I don't think we would have Napster, BitTorrent, and so forth. I'm pretty sure when I say it. If the development of source code had still been confined to firms and employers and the state. It is because this technology is developed in the community by people who are, by users and so forth, that these things actually happen. And I think this is what is actually the interesting part. Oh God, 5 minutes. This is problem. Okay. Let's see. So I have to think how to do this best. Yes, so okay. So I will just throw it out very quickly and you will have to come back to me. I think that the firms have lost the employment contract and they have lost the bureaucracy, the hierarchy, to some extent, of course not fully, but there is a tendency, as a means of organizing the code that is being written, the technology. So what does substitute for that? What substitutes for that is intellectual property. That is essentially what the license is. The license is a new way of controlling what kind of production, what kind of ideas and innovation is taking place within the community. It has standard in and extended the control which the firms can have over this activity. And I think this is a more fruitful way of looking up on it than looking up on it as just a conflict between consumers and producers, which makes no sense if you start to look at the facts. So I can see a lot more of that, but maybe I have to hurry. Yes, I want to try one idea with you. And I would like to try the idea that the free license is actually an attempt to organize, to unionize this very loose or to replace the union as a form of organizing these interests. And I will very quickly try to run through it, and I'm very interested to get your response. This is my idea. The unions the unions have very little to achieve or give. It's very ill adapted to the situation of a software programmer in many cases, to the extent that you are a freelance or you work on a contract or you are a temporary worker and so on. The unions come to very much for you. But the situation here is that what the firms have lost is the control over the tools which you use to develop technology, because the tools used to be huge machines, they used to be factories, so forth, which naturally the workers couldn't control themselves. But with software development, the tools are basically the code. What the intellectual property system does is that it places the ownership of the code in the hands of the industrialists, the owners. This is how that way they control the code, and by controlling the code, they can also control what you contribute next, because you need to get that access in order to build something new from it. And what the free license does then is that it says everyone has the same access to the code. There is you cannot discriminate who has the right to use the tool and to apply it with his skills and then do something with it. Also to commercialize it, or whatever way of making a living from it. And this, on one hand, of course, obviously, IBM, Google, and so forth, is in a much better position than you are in taking advantage of this situation, of course. But the problem for the firm is that the only thing it has is ownership over either machines, or it has ownership over legal ownerships, but it cannot have skills. The skills necessarily belongs to you. So what the free license does in this case is that it places the advantage to the only scarcity left in the market, that is the skills. And this is also how I see this as essentially coming down to the question, who has the knowledge and who has the skills over this situation. So, to summing up, my idea is that one should see the hackers, and to some extent the file sharers, but in a different way, as an example of a new social movement, which has made a synthesis, in a sense, between the old left, or the old labor movement, and the new social movements. And what is at heart of these struggles, what is at heart when it comes to intellectual property, is who controls the forms of creativity and development. And if there is any time left, I will leave it to get the opinions and the objections and questions.
What do you think about the cyberpunk movement?
The cyberpunk movement?
Yeah.
I don't know really.
How would you place it in relation to the free software movement?
How do you mean cyberpunk?
Well, the imaginary of cyberpunk is like this post-industrial aesthetics that is being also like pretty much represented by steampunk nowadays in design. And it's an imaginary,
Definitely. I think one couldn't make a direct connection to the imaginary of the music of 68 and so on if you want. But to be honest, I haven't really thought so much of that side of it. but I think maybe you have more to say. Maybe.
Well, I've been, I mean, I'm a cyberpunk myself, or post-cyberpunk, because it was declared to be dead in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting phenomenon, cultural phenomenon, especially since it has been revamped after the 9/11 disaster by all these campaigns against the privacy of people, which actually realized a cyberpunk imaginary that was just science fiction 20 years ago and is now really through. So yeah, well, I'm interested in recognizing this as a movement, and sometimes I quoted with other free software researchers that it's very much has a lot of ties to the free software movement, and some people objected rightfully. I think I'm pushing it a bit too close. Then I'm always curious to know, you know, how people can put into relationship. It's a very wide cultural movement, as the punk movement is. It's a pop. Is a popular culture, and it doesn't need any institution to make it survive. It's actually very viral, so it has some characteristics that are interesting, I think, to take into account.
Could you elaborate something on the lessons learned by feminism in hacking? Because you seem to be making an argument that collapses several social movements into one. So I'd like to learn a bit more about how you see, because obviously, as you say, feminism is an important social movement. So how has it impacted hacking, would you say?
How feminism has had an impact?
Well, you're making an argument that right, there's a relationship between social movements and hacking. And I was wondering, could you please say something about how you see a particular social movement then, feminism, having something to do with hacking?
Yeah.
That's my question.
Okay. First of all, I've been sort of banging together a lot of things here.
Yes. And
you have. It's the time requirement and so on. I mean, feminism in one sense has a much longer history, and you have the suffragettes and so forth. When I was mentioning feminism as an example of the new social movement, I think it was... in that case, it would be fair to say there was a very strong revitalization of the feminist cause, which came hand in hand with also the discovery of the environmental movement, which was perhaps more true to say started there in this new social movement. And I think they being very different, of course, but they were still sharing some common characteristics in relation to the old labor movement. In putting focus away from the labor, the workplace, in trying to find other sensibilities which they were raising, and putting more in question the private life in relation to the public and so forth. So I think that it is in this very, very general sense that I was referring to them as an example of the new social movements. What the relation today is between the feminist movement and the hacker movement is then another completely different question. And I think that... Well, as you read my book, we know there is a few cases of the feminist hackers that are trying to organize, which I've seen. But I think that's basically what I am aware of happening. Yeah?
Have you thought anything about connecting your arguments about Taylorism and open source as a possible resistance to globalization of the computer industry and lots of programming being done in countries, for example, India, where working conditions and regulations are different from here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, this is the ambiguity of the free and open source in that sense. That it's very. I mean, this is why many scholars writing who have discovered hacking free software of late and applied what he knew from before, from how unions were organized and so on, look very often very suspicious towards what they see, because there is a very strong ambiguity, and especially as concerns to open source, as the commercial version of free software. But you have a very strong ambiguity, because of course, from one perspective, open source is a way of outsource and to make cheap the labor which is done in development. And there is a great many cases, a great arguments for doing so by creating this standard which is global. You can more easily put the work to India. But I think that if you want to, if one is to put a global perspective, and if one wants to take a step outside the politics exactly of the license, where do they end up in the end? So, and then of course everything becomes extremely more complicated than the license.